Thanks for listening to the Best of the Doug Gottlieb Show podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday from 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 to 3 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for the Doug Gottlieb Show at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every day on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR.
This is the Best of the Doug Gottlieb Show on Fox Sports Radio.
Boom! What up, America? Doug Gottlieb Show, Fox Sports Radio. Hope you're having an outstanding day, getting ready for an outstanding weekend. No, we do not have NBA hoop yet back on TV. Sorry, no. Don't have it yet. It's getting there. And no, we don't have baseball yet, but it's getting there. It is getting there, but soon enough we will have it, and we got a lot to talk about today. Got just a you know, not a seismic amount, but we got the I'm like looking at my inbox here, and I'm just kind of overwhelmed by stuff. Oof, this is going to be good. Okay, let me get to a couple things that have been interesting to me. Give you the phone number, 877. 99 on Fox. That's 877-99 on Fox. That is, in fact, the phone number. You can also reach out to me via Twitter or Instagram at Gottlieb Show. Bruce Feldman, Fox Sports college football reporter, will join us upcoming in 20 minutes. We'll get his thoughts on the Big Ten's announcement yesterday. That'll be no non-conference games. LeVar Arrington will join us in an hour and a half. Bob Nightingale will join us. And I believe we're going to get Dave Revson, lead host for the Big Ten Network, get his thoughts on why the Big Ten chose to really kind of a week ahead of most people's schedule announce no non-conference games. I've been a parent for 14 years. And today in Newport Beach, California, where I live, there was a paddle out for a young boy named Johnny Vondere. And Johnny is the cousin of our neighbor, or former neighbors. And they're my kids know who he was. And everyone, like, I live in a neighborhood that's pretty interconnected. There's public school kids, there's private school kids, but it's just families, kids, bikes, skateboards, scooters, dogs, everywhere, right? Like, it's not the perfect picture of Americana. It's different from some of the other suburbs I've lived in Connecticut, or lived in Oklahoma City. But it's for Newport Beach, it's as much a community as you're going to find anywhere in California. And this boy was 15 years old, and he hopped on his skateboard in his garage, opened up the garage door, rode the skateboard down the driveway. It was not even dusk, I don't believe, and got hit by a drunk driver and died. Didn't have his helmet on. And obviously, its neighborhood's been shook up. A paddle out is, it's actually, I believe, a Hawaiian tradition, a surfer tradition. You paddle out outside where the waves are, and here in Newport Beach, you do it usually around the pier, the Newport Beach pier. And people say special words, and there's some things that are thrown in the water, and everybody splashes the water, and it's a way of honoring and memorializing somebody who, he was a talented young surfer, he just loved the ocean. And when you're a parent, you have to balance between reasonable fear, okay, reasonable rational fear, and irrational fear. Like, when, I'll never forget this, when we first had, I had twins first, and they were in the NICU. The NICU, if you don't have kids, is the neonatal intensive care unit. They were preemies. They were born 30 weeks, 5 days. Full term for a singleton is 40 weeks. For twins, it's, you know, in the 36 to 38 weeks. So they were preemies. They were 3.5 pounds, essentially. And you knock on wood, you know, with the exception of one of my daughters having some asthma lung issues, they're as healthy and annoying as any other 14-year-olds on the face of the earth. And I remember a couple different stages of when they were babies. one stage was when they were, I don't know, 7 months old, 8 months old, and they started rolling over. And we would actually take turns, I don't know why, staying up at night, because they would, in the middle of the night, they'd roll over and you like want to make sure they're still breathing. And because I don't, it's not really the way that SIDS work in terms of child, you know, suffocation, but I don't know. And my wife's a nurse, like we knew better, but we had this irrational fear, both of us, of something happening to our children. Something happening to our children. Like we would have, at the time we both worked, and, or she was finishing up nursing school early on. And so, you know, I didn't work in the morning. Then I was doing nighttime radio. And so in the afternoon and evening, we would have somebody, a friend of mine, actually Dave Revson's nanny. That's a good, he's joining us today. He had twins that were a year older. And she would come over and spend some time. And my wife, we literally never left the kids home alone with anybody. Maybe till family. And it was an irrational fear. Irrational, unreasonable fear that something would happen, you know, to our children. And knock on wood, thankfully, nothing happened. That doesn't mean you want to be irresponsible and just leave them with any stranger, knock on the door. Hey, do you like kids? Cool. Did you have kids that survived your rearing? Cool. Here's a couple of children for you. Like, nah, that's not really the way it works. But we had this irrational fear of like SIDS for like rolling over. We have all kinds of irrational fears that creep through your head because, I don't know, you see a baby, you've never felt any amount of love like you love your children. And whether it's the 15-year-old down the street who, I think a reasonable fear is your kid falls off his bike or gets struck by a car or isn't looking, isn't paying attention, flips out their cell phone while they're riding their bike or their scooter and something bad happens. It's reasonable to say, hey, that can be dangerous. You can't keep them wrapped in bubble wrap their whole life, but what streets do they go down in order to get from point A to point B? And are they wearing a helmet? That's reasonable. That's rational. But keeping them inside for months on end because you're worried about the world outside and turning them into agoraphobes, that's not reasonable and rational. It's just not. And I think we have to be careful about that with football, right? Football is not a safe game. Now, we've made it, or we attempt to make it safer than it has been, taking away hits with the crown of the helmet, leading with the helmet. Obviously, spearing's been taken off. For quarterbacks, you can't hit near, below, head or above. All right, you have concussion protocols. But football is a violent game. Violent game. And when you get to the collegiate and the professional level, it's an extremely violent game played by remarkable athletes. And so you're never really safe. Okay. But if you sign up to play football, there's a reasonable expectation of level of safety that even if you are going to get hit, the other person is not trying to intentionally harm you. Doesn't mean harm won't exist. Doesn't mean they won't hit you in a way in which they don't mean to, or they might lower their head and get thrown out of the game. But we start with the idea that it's not safe, but it's reasonable to expect the opponent to, while they try and tackle you and make it hurt, not intentionally injure you. Okay, well, with COVID-19, we're kind of at that same place here. If you look at all of the studies, there are questions about you know, transmitting this thing to older people. There are questions about ICUs now that elective surgeries are open, if ICUs will become overrun. There are questions about bringing back all college students because there are college students that have pre-existing health conditions. Okay, pre-existing health conditions. And the problem with that deal is if you bring back all the students, you bring back all the professors, you bring back all of the secretaries, now you open yourself up to litigation because there are people with pre-existing health conditions that you can't screen like you can college football players. For college football guys, like, look, you're going to get a physical, you're going to get checked on, you're going to get tested continually for COVID. Like most people their age aren't getting sick, even if they're testing positive. And if they're getting sick, it's not to the level of hospitalization. And these are the best of the best of the best being treated by the best of the best of the best with the most resources. I think we're at that place, not necessarily of allowing fans in the stadium, but allowing football to exist of irrational fear. There's a reasonable fear of spreading COVID-19 to your home, to your parents, to your grandparents, to other older people, to people with pre-existing health conditions. There's an irrational fear to not allowing sports to exist at all, especially when it's in some sort of bubble and the rest of the world's not in a bubble. Lou Holtz was on Fox News. I love Lou Holtz. I know people make fun of Lou Holtz because he speaks with a lisp. He's a brilliant orator. He comes from nothing, made himself into one of the greatest college football coaches of all time. And he is in the primary risk group in terms of his age. He was asked about football returning. Here's what he had to say.
The way it is right now, they just don't want to have sports. And there's no way in this world you can do anything in this world without a risk. People stored Normandy. I took some grandchildren over there. They knew there was going to be cash. They knew there were going to be risk, but it was a way of life.
Yeah, I don't know if you want to relate it to storming Normandy, but the idea of Normandy was you signed up for it, you knew you're, or I mean, you didn't, you get drafted, you go in, and like that is risk. That is risking your life when that boat door opens up and you're walking on to, you know, Omaha Beach and there's bullets whizzing by. That's not a college football scholarship. It's a little bit overstating it. It's classic television. I get it. But the thing is, there are rational and irrational fears. This is a irrational fear to keep college football players away and to automatically, part of cancel culture, let's cancel because it might be a little risky. I think we've reached the unreasonable part. I think we've reached the Doug Gottlieb staying up late at night doing shifts because his kids were rolling over while they're sleeping, which if you actually look it up, they're less likely for anything to happen to them once they start rolling over because if they can't breathe, it's like an involuntary response. They automatically push themselves up and roll themselves over. Am I making sense? Feels like I am. Coming up next, a former MVP opted out of this league season. Does he deserve to get criticized for it? That's next.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
Doug Gottlieb Show, Fox Sports Radio. He is the lead host and I believe the longest. His tenure has been the longest employed at the Big Ten Network and conducted a really interesting interview yesterday with the commissioner of the Big Ten after their announcement that they are not going to have non-conference games. He's Dave Revson. He's set to join us here on the Doug Gottlieb Show on Fox Sports Radio. Keep in mind, we're going to have another former Big Ten star from Penn State. LeVar Arrington is going to join us in about 10 minutes. What was your reaction to the conference deciding what felt like a little bit earlier than other conferences had come to the conclusion they're not going to play non-conference games?
Well, I'm not all that surprised just because I had heard kind of rumbling about it, Doug. So definitely didn't catch me off guard in any kind of way. But maybe when I initially heard, I think first you're kind of trying to figure out, well, what's the logic here? And it's pretty clear to me the logic is just about controlling that time and taking some variables out of it so that you're only dealing with your own schools. And I think that makes a lot of sense. I know I feel bad for some of the leagues, particularly the MAC, which has a lot of games against the Big Ten. And I understand that a lot of those schools kind of build their finances around playing those games. But I just feel like ultimately each league has to figure out what's best for themselves. We're in uncharted territory and this makes sense for the Big Ten.
Is it an ancillary benefit that they save money? Because, you know, there's at this point, we don't know about fans in the stands. and you don't have to pay for conference games. So you are going to save, you know, $1 million on most of these buy games or so. Is that just an ancillary benefit, or was that a primary benefit?
Well, I don't know the details on that, like what the decision-making process was, I guess the best way to say it.
Yeah.
You know, you may end up, I don't know whether you have to pay those off or not, Doug. I mean, I guess it depends on what the wording is in the contract, whether or not there was some sort of a clause in it for, you know, the
force majeure
act of God or whatever it is.
Force majeure.
Yeah, the force majeure. I mean, I know you speak Latin. I speak English, so.
I'm more pig Latin. I took pig Latin in school. It was.
But anyway, so yeah, whether I don't know what the wording is. I mean, but I don't think that's why they did it. I think this is just about making sure that you're playing teams where you know exactly how they're testing. You're testing the same way they are. And then it gives you some flexibility where you can say, okay, maybe we have 13 or 14 weeks to fit in 10 games. And so then if you have to cancel a game, you're able to, you know when everyone's open dates are, and you can play around with the schedule and rearrange it.
Weird times, right? Like, when's your bus tour normally go?
First week of August.
And is there any plans for that?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, I really haven't even asked. Like, I think it's so funny, right? Like, I would just be so happy if we played. And I think you think about, like, college football in an average year, where we just get so bent out of shape, yelling at one another about 9-game conference schedules versus 8-game conference schedules, whether a 2-loss team should get more consideration than a 1-loss team if it played a tougher non-conference schedule. I don't care about any of that this year. I don't know if you do. I don't. I just want to see the games. I want to see kids be able to play. I want to see fans have something to distract themselves from what has been a very difficult time for a lot of people, I think emotionally, in terms of health, economically, all those different things. I think we just kind of need it if we can do it. We need sports right now from a mental point of view. And so, I don't know. I'm kind of in beggars can't be choosers mode. My sense is we're not doing a bus tour, but who knows? I guess we'll just kind of see what happens here in the next few weeks.
No, listen, I'm with you on playing. I just, you know, I had a powerful college basketball coach reach out to me in text, and he's like, look, this is about the kids and playing and getting the experience of playing. If you're an older coach or one that believes you're at risk, the coach from the stands, you know, you can put mask and gloves, or, you know, in football, coach in the press box and stay away from the kids. But it should be about the players getting that experience. What are the chances, have you heard, as far as the season being moved to the spring and the viability of that?
Well, it's interesting. Sandy Barber, who's the athletic director of Penn State, the other day said something to the effect of that's a last resort, if you will. So I don't think that that's the first plan by any stretch for the Big Ten, but I think it would be not playing at all. It was interesting. We had Urban Meyer on yesterday, and he was saying I think it would be really tough in terms of the turnaround, that you'd have guys who have been through a full season. He said, you know, your body really gets beaten up when you play a full college football season. And then you tell me you're going to turn around and be in camp again 3 months later. But I think if you played a spring season, it would probably be somewhat abbreviated. And so maybe you can't think about us going through the grind that Urban's used to with 12 regular season games and then a conference championship and then one or two postseason games. I think you're thinking more in terms of maybe it's 8 games or 10 games. So, I don't know. To me, I think they're going to do everything they can to play, but it's not if it's going to be at the detriment of the health of these players. I really firmly believe that ultimately that's, at least in the Big Ten, what the decision's going to be made on. And if they can't do it in a way that's healthy, Kevin Warren said it on our air yesterday. He said, this is not a fait accompli that we're going to have this season. It is certainly within the realm of possibility there won't be play.
Do you know when the drop dead date is?
I don't know. I mean, I would guess early August. You really have to have a plan, right? So I don't think we're that far away. I mean, I think we're 3 or 4 weeks away from needing some sort of concrete plan.
Yeah, I guess my thing is I know there's more positive tests, and that's very, very alarming. And I know the hospitals are filling up. I think some of it is obviously COVID. Some of it is also the fact that elective surgeries are back. And we didn't have elective surgeries for months, obviously, because things were shut down. So the combination of the two kind of coinciding. But, you know, is there a thought that you can, could you do it without fans? Could you do it without students on campus?
I feel like there kind of has to be college for there to be college football. So I kind of think you need to have some students. I think otherwise you're sending a message basically that these guys are expendable. You can have them all around one another, but you can't have the other students on campus unless you were going to build the counter argument of, well, they would be safer because you wouldn't have as many people around.
Correct.
Doing unsafe things potentially. I mean, maybe you could construct it that way.
I also think that, like, look, there are pre-existing health. If you have a health concern, you're probably not a college athlete, right? And my thing has always been, I do think that being on campus is safer than being at home. One, because of medical care and you're getting tested more often. But two, because when you're at home, you're not in the bubble. So you're having the same number of interactions with other people and other families and with no protection. Whereas at least when you're with your college football team, theoretically, you can isolate yourself within the walls of or within the realm of your college football team, even if there's not students around. By the way, you can protect them if they get sick and treat them kind of immediately, as opposed to, you know, Ohio State, you get 60,000 students there. You can't protect anybody and you open yourself up to more litigation.
Look, as you know, I mean, I have a daughter who is starting college this year. And so from my point of view, I feel comfortable with her going, but I would want them to be testing a ton. I'd want them to have a really good system of isolating people, quarantining them when they're positive. And I think every kid that goes on a college campus needs to put an app on their phone that traces them and shows where they've been, that is used only when someone tests positive. And then you see where those people have been, and you get a ping on your phone that you were around someone who tested positive and you need to go get tested. And I think you can create a little bit of a bubble there, and I think you can be safe. So I feel comfortable with a kid going to college. I'm not sitting here as someone saying, well, I'm removed from this. No, I'm okay with her doing that. But I just think we have to do it sensibly. And I don't know whether that means sports or not. I think we kind of need to see where we are here in a few weeks. But I do think there are ways to control this. We just haven't done a great job of it.
I agree. Dave Revson, joining us, lead host for the Big Ten Network. Okay, this is going along with your oldest, kind of same question. If the classes move online, I had this discussion with the neighbor. The classes move at Northwestern solely online. Does she take the year off or does she take the classes?
Well, unfortunately, I think we've passed the point of no return.
There is no opt out. They're not going to give you a refund. Here, we'll give you our money back. You guys take the year off. You're good.
A lot of these schools, it's been pretty interesting. They set kind of May 1st as the date, because otherwise, if you put it up in the air, I mean, let's use, as you said, so my daughter's going to Northwestern. They have 8,000 students, 2,000 a year. So let's say 500 kids decide on August 15th that, okay, I don't want to do that. What does that mean for the class of 2021? So now you're going to have 2,500 people in that class, or how are you going to do it? You know, they lose out on a ton of revenue, and I think that's what each one of these schools is looking at. So I don't think she'd be thrilled with it, but I'm not sure she'd really have much of a choice at this point. They're basically saying if you don't go most of these places, that you forfeit your place.
Best guess, do we play in the fall?
I still am optimistic, just because why not? But, I mean, I think it's really close. Like, when you have people like Kevin Warren, we had Gene Smith, the AD at Ohio State, on yesterday, and they are very openly saying, hey, look, there's a chance we don't play. You don't say that unless there's a strong chance you don't play. There's no reason to open that can of worms up. So I'll go 60-40, yes, that we have some form of a season, but it wouldn't shock me if we didn't. And unfortunately, like, look, I 2 months ago, I was 90-10, yes. But it just is headed the wrong way.
Dave, 87 today? Is that on like the famed links of Tunxus National, or are we talking Muni? Are you still a Muni guy?
That's a pretty good course. I played okay. I stumbled to the finish. I had a nice front nine, and then I think I played the last three and five over, which is kind of par for the course for me. I'll, you know, throw in a few doubles just so my score doesn't get too good, because I'm not clutch and I always pulled in the critical moments. But I hit the ball okay. Not bad.
Yeah, so your par for the course is bogey.
Where was your 91 yesterday?
Yeah, 91 was at Aviara in San Diego. So it was a nice course. I mean, it was my first time out since February.
Wow.
So, I mean, there was some good there. My short game was awful. I mean, awful.
My recollection is that you hit the ball a long way, but you don't always know where it's going. Is that a fair characterization?
You know what? Honestly, now the issue is not where it's going off. I hit the ball a long way. I did hit one driver and I crushed it, but I'm so hesitant with the driver. But the three wood, I hit really well and really long off the tee and generally know where it's going. And I'm a good iron player. It's just, once I get around the green, I was just bad. I just inexplicably
bad. Well, the short game's just practice.
Yeah, and I don't practice.
You just got to get out there and practice. Yeah.
I don't practice. Yeah. I don't believe in it.
Well, like
practice?
You
talking about practice? We talking about practice? I don't practice. We got to get together and do that. Hey, congrats on the 87, and look forward to continued health. We'll talk soon.
All right, my friend. Thanks for having me on.
That's Dave Revson. He was my first ever play-by-play partner in the business. He was a play-by-play. I was color. In the business. And, of course, the lead host for Big Ten Network. Let's get you to Dan Beyer. Find out what else is going on. DB, what do you got?
Giants catcher Buster Posey not going to take part in the shortened season. He will not play in that 60-game season that for the Giants starts in less than 2 weeks. Posey and his wife adopting premature twin babies. They're required to be in intensive care. And Posey just said in a statement, it came down to the unknown, so he's not going to play for the Giants this season. Jacksonville Jaguars announcing their home games will only accommodate 25% of their capacity at TIAA Bank Field this season. And NFL Network reports says the NFL will require fans to wear masks if they are allowed in stadiums this season. As for training camps, though, fans won't be allowed to attend those practice sessions. Broncos safety Justin Simmons will sign his franchise tender by the end of the weekend, according to a report from ESPN. Duke head coach David Cutcliffe says he favors a plan in the ACC where they only play conference opponents. That would mirror the plan laid out yesterday by the Big Ten Conference. They are back playing golf in Dublin, Ohio at Muirfield Village. It's the Workday Charity Open. Colin Morikawa done for the day at 13 under par. They've had a couple of storms in the area, so play has been halted, but now resuming for the rest of the afternoon. Wimbledon announced that the 620 players who qualified for the canceled 2020 event will split a pot of $12.6 million. Men's and women's singles players who qualified for the main draws will each receive just over $31,500. Doug, back to you.
Doug Gottlieb Show, Fox Sports Radio. You see him on Speak for Yourself. He was a great football player and an even better dude. LeVar Arrington joining us here in the Doug Gottlieb Show on Fox Sports Radio. LeVar, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How about yourself?
I'm good, man. Let's start with football. I want to get to your thoughts on the Redskins, a team that you played for and that many people believe you're synonymous with. But let me just start with kind of the football aspect to things, college football wise. If you were a college All-American, you were arguably the best player in the country. Would you go and play college football if they said, hey, you can sign a waiver if you want to play or not. You were going to be drafted in the first round anyway. Would you go play?
Oh. All right. So, I mean, there's so many elements to that question, Doug. Like, I mean, the simple, quick, easy answer is, with all of the uncertainty and all the risk involved, would probably be no. I mean, I would probably say no unless it was – collectively everyone was playing. You know, like, I think what the reason why you just made the question complicated is because the waiver sets off a red flag. You know what I mean? Like, if you got to sign a waiver and it's like independently you have to sign a waiver to be able to play this team sport that you are attending school, being on that team is paying for your education, you know, you never really think of it from the standpoint of if you have the choice. So when you add waiver into the situation, and if you already have solidified your career in college, and you don't know, like, what does that even mean? How many people are going to play? How many teams are going to play? There's a lot of uncertainty that would be created based off of the waiver. Now, if you take the waiver away and say, if you're asking me, if the teams are playing and they're deciding to play based upon the given scenarios that this is how we're going to try to approach it and we're going to try to stay healthy this way, then I certainly would play. But waiver sets off a red flag for me.
Fair enough. It's a deeper way of thinking and looking at this than I had even thought of. It's a great point. LeVar Arrington joining us on the Doug Gottlieb Show on Fox Sports Radio. Again, college football. I believe those non-conference games, which people make fun of, are not only a necessity in terms of finances for both universities and for the college towns, but also cranking up and get ready for the season. Like, if every game's a conference game, that's really hard. How much does it change the college landscape if you play an additional conference game and everyone's a league game?
For the winners, it will be advantageous. For the losers, there will be an asterisk, right? Like, if you're able to navigate through conference play without having tune-up games and really working through some of the things timing-wise and just continuity-wise that you work on early on in the year, it's going to definitely raise the stakes on how the season is played. But with that being said, it creates another element of entertainment for the onlookers and for the fans, because you're looking at it with an added element of you know, difficulty, basically. So it'll be interesting to see how the coaches and the players are able to mentally, emotionally, and physically navigate having an abbreviated season that takes you right into conference play.
When you played for the Redskins, did you? My issue with the Redskins nickname being changed is there's no question it always feels discriminatory. It felt weird, like, to have a name like Redskins. On the other hand, you're like, well, and again, this is just my perspective, Lamar, not necessarily shared by anybody else.
It's LeVar, man. I'm not Lamar Jackson. I'm LeVar.
I said LeVar. What did I say? I said LeVar.
You hit me with Lamar. Lamar's such a big name. I get Lamar at least three times a day now, but go ahead. It's all right.
My bad. LeVar Arrington joining us on the Doug Gottlieb Show. LeVar, I'm fascinated. Like, I did think that the intent of the Redskins, not just the nickname, but also the imagery in the side of the helmet, was to honor Native Americans. And now the discussion is, all right, now you change the nickname, but you want to remove any Native American imagery. I almost feel like that actually goes so counter to what they're doing or what anyone's positive intent would be. I feel like erasing positive imagery is not as bad, but almost as bad as erasing negative imagery and the nickname that has people upset. What as a former player, but also as a black man who doesn't, you know, you don't, I'm sure you feel a desire to speak out on things. What's your feeling on taking away the nickname, but the imagery?
You just broke news to me. I'm black. I'm a black man.
Come on, dude.
Holy moly. Let me go look in this mirror real quick. No, I'm joking. It is a very serious topic on a more serious note. And as a former player on the team and knowing, because I have a ton of family, the origins of my dad's side of the family are from Virginia. So I've known about the team and have been, you know, connected to that team for my entire life. I just was always under the impression that the people that I discussed the name with in that regard were more often than not were of the mindset that they were not offended by the name and were actually honored that was, you know, they were being depicted that way. Now, with that being said, those were direct conversations. This is not me speculating about it. This is me having conversations with certain tribes, certain Native Americans that fell on the side of that being their belief. So for me, I kind of didn't think too much about it, even though I saw different groups of Native Americans at every single event, at every single game, protesting the name. So for me, I just always felt as though, you know, I had a conflict because I felt as though there was this side that felt a certain way and it was that side that felt a certain type of way. And my rationale was always, well, you'll never have one side of black people feel like the N-word is actually honoring them, right, whereas the other side feels like the N-word is derogatory term towards them. And maybe I was guilty of settling in on basing it off of my own personal rationale versus really seeing the totality of what it really truly represented. So I look at it from the standpoint of, if anyone of that background, that racial background, of the Native American background, if any one group is offended by what it represents, then it's offensive. That's kind of it for me. Like, I don't go any further than that. The older that I'm getting, the more I'm just kind of trying to simplify things, Doug. And yeah, I think to simplify it is to say, if any group of people that it is related to, I don't care if 5 people or 10 people over here say I'm okay with it, if any group of people that it is directly related to are offended by it in a racially driven way, then it should be addressed in a way that is sensitive to what their rights represent and who they are and what their background represents. If it doesn't say richness and culture and celebration of the culture and the belief in the culture, and that isn't a total theme or a total storyline across the board, and it's checkered and it has blurred lines on it, then it has to be addressed. And what the final result of that is, that's not on me to decide what the final decision on it is. But I will say, I do think that if people are offended by it, and I've always said this, if people are offended by it that are of that group of people, then it needs to be heard.
But you brought up something that, because you had those conversations, you believed it to, you knew it to be true, that there was support for the nickname for a long time, and that support seems to have either evaporated or really, really slowly disintegrated. How much of it comes down to it's Dan Snyder and people just don't like him? And how much of it comes down to the team is just not any good? It can't be a source. In addition to the nickname, you know, not being a source of pride, the team itself not having, how much of that do you think plays any sort of factor in what I think we would both agree is a change from when you played and had those conversations?
It's a great question, Doug, because for me, I look at the conversation has always existed. The debate has always existed, and it almost came down to a moral code, moral compass decision for Dan to change the name and move forward from it. But I always told people, with the reasoning that I just gave on the last question, when you think about from a businessman's, if you're putting your business person's hat on, that person purchased a brand. He purchased a brand that was valued at over $1 billion. So when he paid 800 and some, 850, whatever it was that he paid for that franchise, he was paying for an established brand. And so I always had the kind of back and forth with myself about what that represents, because if you purchase Nike and all of a sudden, some way, somehow, we found out that Nike had a hidden meaning that was a racial slur, and the person who purchased Nike is now being told they have to change the logo and change the name based upon it being a racial slur, I'm sure the person who purchased Nike at whatever that dollar amount is would be upset and apprehensive and not wanting to change what it is that they paid in value for. So when I look at it, is it more about Dan? I don't think it's more about Dan Snyder. I don't think it's more about them losing. I think it's just the climate in which our country is in right now. Everything is on the table, and if it is racially driven right now, it is a target, and it is going to get some of the fiercest, intense attention that we've seen in this country as it applies to, you know, racial equality and racial reform and racial discussions, racial sensitivity. There is going to be an intensity level that is there now that has not been. And I think that that's what's probably going to end up, if not have already done, drown out the voices that actually said that they weren't offended by this. And it's also going to strengthen the resolve and the reasoning that is going out there that's saying, okay, well, if Black Lives Matter, if you're saying to me Black Lives Matter, then shouldn't Red Lives Matter? Shouldn't these lives, you know, we put blue out there, and a blue isn't even a person. That represents a department. So I think that the narrative, Doug, is what has created such a loud voice and a voice that obviously has made FedEx become very, very, has some serious trepidation about moving forward with the name being the same, the owner being a minority ownership partner in the team, Nike having trepidation being connected to Kaepernick the way they are, and some of the other things that they're dealing with that the spotlight could possibly end up on Nike for. I think that now it just makes it almost impossible for anyone who's running down the lane like the Washington football team. It makes it difficult and impossible for them to move forward right now.
LeVar Arrington, former star running back, linebacker with LeVar, you got me frazzled.
It's all good, man. I was LeVar running Arrington. Back in high school, Doug.
I know. And then, of course, the star at Penn State and with the Washington Redskins. Thanks so much for joining us, LeVar. Appreciate it.
I appreciate you having me on, Doug.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific.
Doug Gottlieb Show, Fox Sports Radio. I got a problem with J.J. Redick. I like J.J. a lot. J.J. Redick's one of those guys that it's interesting, you know. I remember when J.J. was drafted out of Duke, and you'd say, like, man, he was taken with the 11th pick overall in the 2006 NBA draft. People are like, well, I don't know, right? That's kind of high. And you look back now, and you try and figure out, all right, did he live up to the draft expectations? Andrea Bargnani went 1 overall. LaMarcus Aldridge, 2. Adam Morrison. You should check out my podcast with Adam Morrison. Ammo was awesome. 3. Tyus Thomas, 4. Sheldon Williams, yikes, 5. Brandon Roy, 6. Randy Foy, 7. Rudy Gay, 8. Patrick O'Brien, 9. Mohamed Sané, 10. And J.J. Redick, 11. Like, you could make the argument that outside of LaMarcus Aldridge and Rudy Gay, I mean, he's been the best draft pick of that entire first round. That's not even a crazy argument. You go through that entire draft and you're like, wow, it's pretty remarkable that Paul Millsap went in the second round. He might be the third best draft pick of the entire draft. So I like JJ a lot. I think he's a great interview. He's got a podcast. He did a sit down with Taylor Rooks, and he said, in Kevin Durant in 2016 when he joined the Warriors, LeBron James when he makes a decision, there'll always be a group of fans that want to make the argument, oh, he took the easy way out. He went and joined Dwayne Wade, Chris Bosh in Miami. Or in Durant's place, he went and joined a team that just beat him in the NBA playoffs. But I think the underlying reason for the reaction to Kevin and to LeBron making those decisions is people were uncomfortable with powerful black men making a decision for themselves. I really believe that. Huh? What? JJ, what the hell are you talking about? The negative reaction to Kevin Durant's decision, and by the way, for the record, I was the one who was like, I get it. Just basketball-wise, they were playing 1-2 on 5 in terms of the spacing on the court. You know, do I think it was that he didn't play well in game 6 and that we don't normally see that. And I don't know, joining him just felt a little dirty. Like, sure. But for if he said he made the decision because of basketball, that made sense. Made sense. But JJ basically saying, it's because they're black, racism. That's why, like, JJ, that's just stupid. That's ignorant. Because, and I got in this discussion with John Calipari 1 year. You know, John Calipari was then the coach at Memphis. And one of his teams, after he lost the national championship game, he lost Derrick Rose. That was a great team. That actually wasn't as talented a team NBA-wise as the Kansas team they were playing against. But it was a great team, and Derrick Rose, obviously, they were 2 minutes away from winning national championship, up 9, missed some free throws, gave up a 3, as time expired, lost in overtime. But one of his next couple teams was really young, and I was asked to, you know, like a pregame show, how do you beat Memphis? And I said, you know, put him in the half court and you make him think. He calls me and he says, that's racist. I'm like, what? Well, that's racist. You said, make him think, you know, I have an all black team, make them think. You're saying that they're black kids, they can't think. And I said, John, if you were to do a self-scout, how would you scout your team? I said, well, he's like, well, we're much better. We're good. We're kids are tough. They get after defensively. You know, we're really good in transition. We're learning in the half court. I was like, okay, do you learn more the longer you play? He's like, yes. Do you think you become better in the half court the longer you play? Yes. Do you think your basketball IQ grows the longer you play? Sure. Okay, so what am I missing? My self-scout is the same. I got 15 to 45 seconds to say what I want. I can't make a comment about your team, considering they're all black and I'm white, and then if you want to make it to be racist, like, why are you searching for something that's not there? When you play a Roy Williams coach team at Kansas, half white, half black, whatever they were, they had an all black team. It doesn't matter. The way to beat Roy Williams team is put them in the half court. Don't let them run. Why would I say make them think? It had nothing to do with them being black at Memphis. It has to do with the fact that when you're young, you just react. You don't have to. You're just playing and having fun. Now, all of a sudden, wait, they're changing defense. They're big in half court. They're slowing the game down. We got to get into running an offense and understanding time and score. That's thinking. It doesn't mean that they won't accrue that knowledge. It's not part and parcel to, like, you're searching for something. Like, JJ, if you went back and watched, the people who were most vicious on the attacks of Kevin Durant were Stephen A. Smith. Called it the weakest move in the history of the sport. Stephen A. Smith, a closet racist? Like, that's just an ignorant comment. Any decision made by powerful NBA players, if you go against it, like, one, if it's, it's because basketball players have power. Like, all right, Shaquille O'Neal was a free agent, and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar forced his way out of Milwaukee. Like, obviously, we didn't have sports talk TV, but the powerful black men in the NBA have made decisions for years. The criticism of LeBron James, and look, I will grant that JJ was in college at the time as like a freshman. If he goes back and remembers, it's because they went to the Eastern Conference Finals 2 years in a row, won 66 and 61 games, and then he left and formed a super team in Miami, leaving his hometown team. That was the criticism. And a lot of people weren't criticizing him at all after Dan Gilbert had that stupid letter, right? The Comic Sans letter. But the reason that everybody was mad, the only reason people were mad were like, why'd you do some weird press conference in Greenwich, Connecticut? Why'd you have, what's his name, Gray doing the interview, and it was like he was setting you up for questions. It was very weird. By the way, like, you're going to a what at the time was thought to be a passionless sports town in Miami who had already won a title. Just, you're forming a super team. Like, all right. Could have gone to New York. That meeting obviously was a disaster. He looked around and he wanted to go to Miami, but it was in no way critical of him because he was a black man making, like, that's just dumb. That's like, we can't default everything on, it's gotta be racism. I got in this argument with who was it? John Feinstein on Twitter. Like, Chicago Bears picked the wrong quarterback when the Chiefs drafted Pat Mahomes and the Texans drafted Deshaun Watson. But I actually talked to the Bears. Like, race had nothing to do with why they selected Mitchell Trubisky. Now, a lot of people were critical of the Mitchell Trubisky draft pick when it was when they traded up in the draft to take Mitchell Trubisky, who had only started, I think, like 14 games at North Carolina. You can make a bad decision, and Ryan Pace is the GM of the Chicago Bears, by misevaluating a guy and having nothing to do with race. Deshaun Watson had been hurt in college. They took the entire front office and scouting department to see his pro day, and for whatever reason, they didn't like it. They all went and saw Pat Mahomes, and they liked it, and they thought, and this is what I was told, higher ceiling than Mitch Trubisky, lower floor. Lower floor. And other people thought that. And remember, Pat Mahomes has always been a super talent, but he had some flaws coming out of college. But he worked with one of the best quarterback gurus and offensive staffs in football with the Kansas City Chiefs. He didn't play the first 16 games of the season, didn't play in the playoffs the first year. They surrounded him with just Tyreek Hill, Sammy Watkins, Travis Kelce, like dude after dude after dude. They had dudes everywhere and great play caller, and he had a year to learn. All this helped all his talent come out. You can make a bad decision, like the Bears did, not be about race. You can not like LeBron James or Kevin Durant leaving the only team they never played for and not make it about race. That one's embarrassing. The J.J. Redick one's embarrassing to me because the people most critical of Kevin Durant specifically, his decision, were former NBA players and Stephen A. Smith.